This week, we grab President Obama for a selfie. Welcome to the Midwest Peace Process.
Ladies and gentlemen,
I have the pleasure to present to you now.
I have the pleasure to present to you
the Midwest Peace Process.
The world is very different now.
The Midwest Peace
To remind
Process.
America of the fierce urgency of now. Now.
Welcome to episode 70. Today is April 18th, 2014. I'm Jerry.
I'm Jeremy.
And this is Rob.
Hey, how's it going?
We're going to get in trouble for that 70. Intro, I think.
You think?
They're going to hear that, grab President Obama. And
yeah, right. Take it out of
it's
context.
Just a way for us to get listeners.
We're already on so many watch lists. It's not even crazy.
It's our name.
To start off, I want to say our break music this episode is brought to you by the Polish ambassador.
Oh, one of my favorites. Just by chance, it showed up on the podcast.
How about that?
Oh, listen to the Ecozoic album just over and over again on loop, and it will teach you things.
All right. So if anybody out there is a Polish ambassador fan, let us know.
I am.
So this show is about too much government. Thomas Jefferson said, most bad government has grown out of too much government. This week was tax day. Just a reminder of how much we love our government and all the services that they provide us. It's our annual exercise in pretending we're not being robbed at gunpoint. And that we're all voluntarily giving our hard-earned money to Uncle Sam so that he can figure out how best to spend it. This should make us all wonder about the ways it is being spent. And we have a few examples to discuss this evening. Perhaps a few less than when we started.
Maybe.
In the pre-show discussion, we whittled the list down to, I think, zero.
All right, good night.
Yeah. All right, thanks for listening. Talk to you later.
Well, to little preemptive shot across the bow.
Let's hear it.
Rob admitted that Obamacare is a bust. He won't say it again on record. But
that's right.
I did not admit said things.
We were not recording yet when he said it, so.
I like to give advice to my opponents. That's what I do. I feel like it breeds goodwill with Jeremy.
No, see, that's where you're wrong. Well, I'm not supposed to be your opponent.
Oh, you're my...
Right, this is a collaborative effort.
Collaborative,
we're trying to
problem,
solve the
Rob.
World's
For
problems.
For those that disagree. But what I was mentioning was that I may have had a liberal realization that all liberals do have. That
not all.
Yeah, sadly, not all.
That I think a more effective argument against liberal ideas isn't so much the government versus free market idea, because that doesn't hold much water with me, because I think free market enterprises can be just as evil and awkward and expensive and stupid as anything else.
Agreed.
But it's possible that a better argument against things like healthcare is just an argument against organizations that are too large for their function, which government is, which maybe this healthcare is an example of, or large corporations. I think there's examples of in the business world where we like to think, well, you know, these businesses, they need to run at maximum efficiency, because we're in the dog-eat-dog world of competition, and if they don't run efficiently, they're going to get eaten up by their competition. So they're in some kind of Darwinian sense, they're running at maximum efficiency and power, and that's just not true.
Right.
I think there are people in large organizations, whether it's a public thing like a school district or something like any large corporation, Express Scripts,
right.
Amarin, whatever it is, Amarin being kind of a public thing, but just whatever it is, things that become too large become inefficient for stupid reasons.
Well, you're saying that like it's new, but if I may pat myself on the back and strain my shoulder a little bit, I said that to you a long time ago. When we were talking about Obamacare back in the fall, I said, what has government done that that really you think, wow, that works really well. We should put them in charge of it.
Right. And well, I guess it comes down.
There you go.
What? I didn't even start yet.
Yes, you did. You start off with the, well, right. And then that's your.
No. I think you do have a good case about the government. But now you got to figure out, well, what's going to be better? Let's say before Obamacare we had a free market system, which we didn't really with the Medicare and everything, but one could say that it was more free market than the Obamacare, which is the main criticism of Obamacare. Oh, you're taking the market out of it. Well, how well did that market system do at treating people, at being efficient, at spending the least amount of money, at providing the best amount of services to the most amount of people? How well did it do in that? It didn't do very well. So I agree with the failings, but I personally, with a healthcare type thing, I think a government solution of an Obamacare style, it's like admitting that the problem is out of hand and is trying to get it under control.
So, to be fair,
don't be fair.
To be fair, the market has provided all of those services completely adequately to those who can afford it.
Right.
We have added a new dimension to the problem. Yes. By saying there are, you know, there's this class of people out there who can't afford health care. What can they do for them?
Right.
Well, okay, so the system wasn't designed to provide free health care.
Exactly.
So it's not fair to criticize it and say, oh, well, it doesn't do a very good job of providing all this stuff to the maximum number of people. The maximum number of people includes all these people who can't afford to pay for it. So,
and that's a little bit, and you may have just hit on it, where I think a lot of the difficulties with the healthcare argument is the two sides are trying to solve different problems. Right, and there's certain kinds of healthcare that you can receive, and to make a caricature of it, you could talk about plastic surgery or Botox or LASIK or certain things that you can really shop around from a market perspective and say, well, what Botox shop can I go to that's going to have the best spa treatment? Maybe I get a manicure, whatever it is. You're buying a service with that money. And I think that's what the free market provides. But I think what the Obamacare effort is trying to solve is something way different than that.
I think it is. I read it's a new or a term that was new to me, that Obamacare provides narrow networks.
What does that mean?
That means it's going to give you coverage if you buy through, you know, some of the Obamacare policies, but you have very limited options on what kind of doctor you can pick. So I hadn't heard that term before. A couple days ago, I was reading an article about a lady who had neurological condition, ended up having to have some brain surgery. Well, suddenly her policy didn't cover the meds she needed and all this other stuff. This was in New York, and her congressman stepped in and was actually helping her, but it was talking about the narrow options she had with this new policy. And that is a one-off. I'm sure it's a one-off. I'm not trying to use that as a prime example or anything. It was just something I read, and I saw the term narrow networks. And it talked about people, yeah, they have coverage, but it essentially they were, it's not how it sounded like it was going to be.
Right.
Well, and I think I've ran into conversations where people say, not maybe the brightest of conservatives will say, well, if more people are getting covered, then de facto that means people have to have less coverage. I don't know if that's exactly true, because of, like we say, like the emergency room costs. You know, like people are getting covered no matter what. No matter what happens right now before Obamacare in the glorious W years, if you show up with a condition, and if you go to the hospital too, and there's a little sign, it's fun to read if you see things from a political perspective. It's a fun little sign to read that says, we do not have the right to refuse you of any care, you know?
Right.
And like, I think about the free market kind of philosophy, I like to think of like that sign being in Best Buy, you know? We do not have the right to not let you have whatever TV you want, you know? That's the case for the liberalism argument is that sometimes you need different structures in place to solve those difficult kinds of problems. Free market is great for TVs. Maybe it's not great for a healthy nation.
Right.
But like I was saying before, I think the real argument against the health and Obamacare is not so much the government versus free market idea. It's the large it's the central planning versus the distributed smaller planning that can get more traction, I think.
Yeah.
You're doing great. And I think that's a more compelling argument to me, at least, you know, because I don't believe in this concept. Obviously, to any podcast listeners, if you're out there, you know, I obviously don't believe in this idea that the dog eat dog Darwinian free market world always creates the best solution.
I mean, it doesn't.
Right.
Look at VHS versus Beta. And all, you know, now Blu-ray versus HD.
There you go.
But one last thing on the Obamacare. I think it's interesting that in medicine they have the Hippocratic Oath. One of the last things in it is, above all, do no harm.
Right.
Well, that was not followed.
Maybe it'll be
better. The passing of Obamacare. So, just a little bit of irony to me. But
I still have some high hopes.
Second thing, I agree. And I don't know if I should say I agree or I planted the seed in your head back in the fall when I said this. And now you're latching on. But
it takes a while for the seed to grow.
Big corporations are not, or big anything, big organizations, almost by definition, have inefficiencies.
Right.
And there's... Right.
And I think at the national level, we try to solve things at the national level. I think, and that's why I don't really understand kind of the anger over Obamacare or Obama himself. Like he's the president of a nation, so he's going to try to solve things nationally. That's what his job is as a president. I mean, maybe he should realize that whatever his solution isn't going to work. But when he goes up there in the State of the Union and says we need to give Pell Grants to... I mean, he's solving things on this macro
right.
$300 million.
But is it solving anything? Is it...
Right.
I mean, should that be the job? Or should it be to administer solutions for specific... Like, they have a problem here. Okay,
right.
I'm going to enable them to solve this problem.
Right.
And they have a problem here, and I'm going to enable them in a different way to solve
right.
this problem.
Right. And that's what, like, this sort of sober conservatism would be like, where you're not going to say, I'm not going to get in there because the Constitution. You could just not get in there because it's not going to work.
Right.
Like, I would love, you know, you could be this new kind of conservative that would say, I agree 100% with the goals of Obamacare. I totally agree that we should, everything that's stated as a goal in there, I think we should do that. I don't think anything of this plan is going to pull that off.
Right.
You know, but instead we get constitutional arguments about, you know, whatever it is. And, you know, that, I mean.
So it's like when you're at work, you know, and you have that boss that you don't get along with maybe, or he just likes to micromanage everything. You know, what you really like him to do is when you go to him with a problem, he gets, you know, he gets the resources lined up so that you can go solve the problem yourself. I mean,
right.
that's what you were saying, right?
Yes.
As opposed to, oh, well, I can fix that for you, and then, you know, he...
Then botch it.
Yeah, he completely Fs it up, and...
And now you have two problems, or you say, well, thanks a lot, but that's not the problem I had, and what...
Right.
Whoa, you don't like my solution now?
Oh,
ungrateful, you know.
God, this sounds way too much like real life.
Yeah, and talking about... This came up in the pre-recording discussion.
Yes.
The pre-show.
Pre-show.
It goes on for hours, like all day long we plan for this.
But how ideas come out or initiatives come out that they don't really address anything. It's an initiative of its own, what
right.
do you want to call it? Just
right, it takes on a life of its own.
Yes, you need an initiative, so here's the initiative.
Right.
Was there any evidence to say that will solve any of the problems
right.
or prevent anything? No,
yeah.
But it's the new thing, so we're going to do this.
I would say it's the initiative for the initiative's sake. The
yeah.
point is that you did something.
Yes.
Yeah.
Did it work? Doesn't matter.
Right.
You did. You can point to something that was done.
Right. It sounds very liberal.
And to any to anybody who's paying attention, that is demoralizing, and it drains you of any energy you have to work hard or try to do the right thing, whatever that may be.
So I'll just point out a couple of links in the show notes right now. One was... Let's see. Let me find it here. Jimmy Fallon shreds Obamacare. That was a pretty good video. It was one of his opening monologues last week or the week before, I forget now. But he basically said that Obama's up there crowing about how he got, 7.5 million people signed up. And then he says, yeah, it's amazing what you can accomplish when you make something mandatory and you threaten to fine people if they don't do it.
That's right. The White House says it surpassed its goal for the people enrolled in Obamacare. It's amazing what you can achieve when you make something mandatory and fine people if they don't do it and keep extending the deadline for months. It's like a Cinderella story. It's just a beautiful thing. You make everyone do it. Isn't it great how many people do it? But if you still haven't enrolled, you might have to pay a penalty called the Individual Shared Responsibility Payment, which is 1% of your salary. Then Americans said, man, good thing I don't have a job.
It's like a Cinderella story. And so then the other one is, I think, Jeremy, you put this in here. The census survey revisions mask the health law effects.
Yeah. And I'm not, these last couple of links I've sent or posted, it almost looks like I'm trying to push an agenda. And that's not really what I'm doing. I thought the story was interesting that they've said for a long time we're asking the wrong questions on this survey. So they wanted to revamp the survey.
Right.
Well, the part that got me was that it just so happens that they implemented the new questions when it's going to mask data that we would like to see or any evidence of is Obamacare helping or hurting. Why not wait one more cycle? Because I think in the article it said for, I don't know, 20 years they've been asking the wrong question. For a long time they've known
that this question was bogus. Questions.
And they even say in the article that, well, the new format of questions, they believe it will lower the estimate of uninsured Americans. So they already know going in that it's going to trend that way.
Yeah.
Why do that now? It's to the, bringing up old wounds, but the most open administration, they keep doing things that are counter to that. Even the, whether there's any intent there or not, it's the perception.
Right.
And they just keep doing it over and over again.
So the interesting...
Rob, for you listeners, is shaking his head and smiling and...
Right.
And he's not saying anything.
I think the interesting thing about... Well, so NPR has been covering this for the last week or so, ever since, Obama did his mission accomplished speech and...
You take it easy there.
Well, that's kind of what it felt like. I was like, hey, I recognize this.
I've seen this before.
Yeah. So ever since, they claimed victory and said, well, we signed up 7 million people, even NPR has been saying, well, okay, so the raw numbers are good, but... Let's quantify or qualify that a little bit and say, how many of those are the young invincibles that we were really trying to sign up? Because if we didn't get enough of those, the economics of this thing isn't going to work.
Right.
And I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question yet, but...
I heard 35%.
Oh, really? Okay. I haven't heard that.
I don't know if that's enough, but...
I don't know either. I mean... It seems like all 7 million of them have to be the young people who are willing to pay into the system and not get anything out of it. But, that's just me.
But I saw a headline that said, oh, the good news is that it's a good mix of young and old. I don't know what that means.
It's a good mix.
It's a good mix. What was the bad mix? One young person and 6,999,000.
Right. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some more government stuff that's completely screwed up. So stay with us. right, we are back. We're going to talk about a story that was just in the news last day or two, actually, about an FBI agent visiting a gun shop in, I think it was South Carolina. Is that where it was? If I remember
right. I
didn't
read the article. I just sent you the link because I thought it was funny that he was looking for people who were talking about big government, and
yeah,
our topic was going to be too much government.
So the FBI agent allegedly left a flyer with the owner of the gun shop with a list of criteria to judge whether or not anybody is engaged in suspicious behavior. Now, one of the things that the FBI agent communicated verbally, it wasn't on the flyer, was that, you know, he was interested in any customers of this gun shop who were talking about big government. And
was handing out flyers one of the signs of somebody?
Yeah, right. That's right. Suspicious activity includes handing out flyers. So anyway, Jeremy shared this with us all, and
Rob started twitching violently.
That's right. Rob pulled an eye muscle, rolling his eyes.
Well, and here's why. The reason why that article was posted
here, let me read what you said.
Oh, please do.
Rob said, "I am generally amused by this faction of society that makes claims about watering the tree of liberty and prying guns from cold, dead hands, and then is shocked when they're pegged with the domestic terrorism label. For these types, would they even believe domestic terrorism is possible?"
That is some tight, clean prose. I'm good in the written word. Pulitzer Prize, please.
Right.
No, that's true. And the reason why these things show up on the sites that they do is to inflame a kind of sense of, oh my God, can you believe that the FBI is looking after us and not these Middle Eastern terrorists?
Whoa. Why don't you ask why that doesn't show up on mainstream media?
Well, yeah, to be fair, this was on InfoWars, so
go. Put that in a box here. We'll put that in a little box and put it to the
that
side.
You won't talk about because you don't
that's
want
right.
to
we'll
address
run,
that.
We'll run out of time.
Do. All right, yeah.
But the reason why that's clickbait for that type of crowd. But my statement stands. I think there are entire factions of people that want to overthrow the government. They and the FBI. What are they in charge of? They're in charge of protecting the government. So they're looking out.
Are they in charge of protecting the government?
Well, they are since 9/11. Certainly,
right.
I'm not sure that's always been their role.
Right. So it's like I don't understand the shock that appears in people,
right,
when they get targeted as somebody to look out for of possibly overthrowing the government. And so a government agency needs to watch out for that. Well, of course, that's their whole point. It's like their natural enemy. So you can't. And then it comes into the whole patriotism label, you know, that some of these people would say that they're the ultimate patriots, but really they're domestic terrorists or they're traitors. And it raises the question of whether there even is such a thing as domestic terrorism, or are they just fighting the good fight against tyranny? Like, was Timothy McVeigh a freedom fighter? Was he a domestic terrorist? And maybe it depends on your point of view. But you can't.
Well, I think it does.
But what did Timothy McVeigh do? He bombed an FBI building. So if the FBI is worried about people like Timothy McVeigh, why should they be so shocked that that's happening?
Well, and so like I said in my response to you, this shouldn't be a conversation about defining what terrorism is. It should be a conversation about the different perspectives and why they're different. So the FBI agent looks at that and says, oh, well, yeah, no question. He's a domestic terrorist.
Right.
Why?
Right.
Why is his perspective so different from mine when I look at, you know, Clive and Bundy, for instance, and say, well, he's fighting the good fight. You know, he's standing up for what he believes are his own individual rights.
Right.
And what he believes is government tyranny. And obviously a lot of the people agree because they, you know, they rush to his aid.
Why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because we haven't actually talked about that on the podcast. That was all in the
right.
pre-show.
Yeah, true. But, we'll get into that. But why is the FBI agent's perspective so different? I mean, he's an American too, right? I mean, he's subject to...
If you just say he's an American too, then you're invalidating the idea of what domestic terrorism is.
Well, no. What I'm saying is he has rights just like everybody else, and occasionally the government violates those rights, and, you know, and he may feel oppressed just like everybody else does.
But or that individual may be violating the laws that the country in which he's a part of.
Okay.
Right. So if there's a law that says you have to pay ranching fees, that's the law, the Constitution, the Supreme Court.
But the agent in the gun store was not necessarily looking for people who are violating any laws.
Just because that it's the law doesn't mean it's legitimate.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's moral. I mean, we talked about this on the show before. Well, there's a higher standard. And that's what, you know, when Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, that's what he was appealing to, is that higher standard.
That's a more abstract and kind of more academic argument. I think what I was mentioning was that it's just, I'm amused by the idea that people would be, like I say, shocked that they would be looking out for them.
Okay.
Know? Well, that's what it's like, well, why do the Cubs hate the Cardinals? It's what they're supposed to do, you know?
And I will grant that to you. I will say that, you know, anybody that's involved in the freedom movement, somebody who, you know, is actively involved in a militia, they shouldn't be surprised when they discover that there are agents of the government
right.
who are either watching
exactly.
them or hunting them down.
Exactly. Right.
I give you that.
Okay. That's probably the only comment.
So, but the question still remains is... Are those people, are they protecting their own rights? Are they, you know, is that a legitimate thing for them to be engaged
right.
in?
Right.
And can they be doing that without being labeled domestic terrorists of some kind?
Right, right.
And I think the answer is yes.
Right, and it might be a matter of degree, but yeah, I guess maybe don't be surprised if they're watching out.
Well, the bottom line is... You know, the framers were considered terrorists by King George,
exactly.
right?
Right, right.
None of us view them that way today. We look at them, I mean, we almost deify them
right.
and say, you know, they were perfect, right?
Right.
They were beyond reproach
right.
for what they did.
Right.
But they're doing the same thing then that, you know, these people in the freedom movement, the militia members, you know, however you want to stereotype them. Those people are doing the exact same thing today that the framers did back then.
So,
and we're categorizing them differently. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think, and to throw a little twist on it, like how does patriotism come into this whole concept? Because some of these people would call themselves the true patriots, and they're
right.
the ones that want to... You know, overthrow the entire government. You know, but that doesn't seem very patriotic.
See, Rob, I think you're saying something inflammatory there.
I am.
They want to overthrow the entire government. I'm not sure I believe that. I don't know that that's their goal or part of their agenda.
Well, who's they? Let's define they, because
yeah.
there are certainly people who want to do that. Are they? Do they comprise 100% of the quote patriot movement? Probably not.
Well, let's get into our Bundy Ranch here. You want
okay.
to sum up the Bundy Ranch, because I think that's an example where there was a conflict between government and citizens, but it wasn't the rules were set to me. Well, maybe you should explain it. But it's an example where everybody knew what the ground rules were. The laws were set. We went through the proper channels with
right.
Supreme Court cases and whatever else. And it was all set. So there wasn't black helicopters coming in because some president decided to do something. It was the rules were set, but this particular person didn't like the rules.
Well, so I think he had reason. From what I've read already about, you know, what Clive and Bundy has said on the record is that his family has been grazing their cattle on that land for four generations since 1877. And he doesn't recognize the BLM's right to impose this grazing fee on him because he doesn't recognize it as federal land. To him, it still belongs to the state of Nevada. It belongs to Clark County. And, you know, he said as much that he would pay a grazing fee if either of those two came and asked him for it, he would pay it. He doesn't feel he owes it to the federal government, however.
But all of this, we have ways of settling these disputes.
Okay.
And maybe not great ways, but that's the way we do it. And you could take, you know, you can have a battle with the government in court, and it'll go through its little
levels. And he did go to court.
Right, and he lost.
Right.
Right, and there were laws back to 1937, whatever, 1938, Taylor Grazing Act, whatever it was, that said these are federal lands that we can lease out to ranchers to graze on,
right,
for a nominal fee. And that's been like that for forever. And so those were the ground rules that were set. And so this guy just says, I don't believe your ground rules. Like, so is that patriotism, or is that just being ornery?
It's patriotic in the sense that it goes back to, you know, a time before the BLM, before, you know, the government really had any kind of hold on the western states. You know, the people that moved out there, that homesteaded all that land and ended up, you know, becoming farmers and ranchers and whatnot. I mean, they had a certain way of life.
Right.
And I don't think it's fair for the government to come in at any point later and say, well, you have to change your way of life because we need some revenue from this land. And I mean, that's what it boils down to. The BLM does nothing to maintain that land. There's way too much of it.
You know, even though the government does that every time they increase property tax, and that's not federal government.
Right.
We need some more money, so you're going to have to change what you...
Yeah.
Because,
so, I mean, I think it's obvious that this was just another source of revenue. There's not any benefit to the farmers from the BLM being the custodian of this land, because if you go back to the point in time before the BLM existed, there were no custodians, and everything was fine. They were able to graze their cattle there, and nobody complained about it because it was, quote, public land.
But your Taylor, I don't think that's exactly true, if I understand this whole Taylor Grazing Act thing. I think the BLM postdated the Taylor Grazing Act back in 1938. I think everybody realized that it was the U.S. government bought this land from Mexico and this Mexican cessation, whatever it was, and that was now the federal government's land. Old Cliven didn't go buy that land from Mexico. The government did. And so now that's the government's land, and they say, well, it's going to be useless to us as a whole government. You all can use it, but it's still our property. That doesn't seem like that. It doesn't seem hair on fire to me. I don't know. It might be my liberal nature, but it seems like a fair agreement that this isn't my land, but you'll let me use it, and I need to use it, so I'll pay you to use it. It doesn't seem like a oh my God, you know, let's...
Well, maybe we should talk about this, because I don't necessarily agree with the rancher. But let's talk about why this suddenly came to a head.
Right, right.
Just tell us a little bit about your old buddy, Harry Reid.
There has been, as I understand it, possible thoughts that this land was earmarked to be used for certain
solar energy company that happens to be a Chinese company.
Right.
That happens to be... Who's going to benefit from this right. sale to the Chinese company?
Represented by Harry Reid's son.
Oh, that's weird. That's not a conflict of interest there at all.
And
right. the
director of the BLM, the current director, just happens to also be Harry Reid's former chief of staff.
That's so weird. Oh, I wonder why.
But wait, they weren't trying to kick the rancher off the land, right? The BLM didn't say, hey, stop grazing this. We need to sell it to China.
They are confiscating his cattle.
Because he didn't pay the fees. The agreement is...
So why not just keep ratcheting up the fees? Why not just, like, you know, okay, we're
because
have a running
guy
total
said,
on
the guy said, the guy said, look, I'm not abiding by our agreement. You said I can graze here and I got to pay you money. I'm grazing here anyway and I'm not paying you money.
But he said he would pay it to the state or the county. Why can't they take the money and then just give it to the Fed? Why can't like,
you're
right,
talking about? I don't know. It's some accounting trick. I don't know. The idea. I don't. Plus, I completely don't.
This goes back to the big government thing.
I completely don't agree with the. I think that's a total smokescreen. Oh, I'll pay it to Clark County or the states. I think he's like, yeah, making the government fight against each other.
Yeah, he may be blowing smoke.
But the idea there is I think I can do whatever I want here, and I want you to stop me from doing it.
So is that Harry Reid's position too?
I thought Harry Reid's position.
I can do whatever I want because represents this company, and my former staff member represents
this. We'll
this.
Need to look at that for
so
the next
I can do whatever
episode,
I want, because I'm Harry Reid.
I'm not so sure how true your claims are.
Not sure how true your claims are. We're all making claims here.
No, and the way I see it is that you just that there's laws in place that govern this agreement, and somebody decided to not abide by the law. Well, what's going to happen when you don't abide by the law? Feds are coming. You know, I don't know what the big surprise is. It is true. I mean,
why should
I don't really agree with your Harry Reid thing, but I think the in all of these things, the government can only do so much. They can only enforce so many things. They have to pick and choose what they think their priorities are, right? And
so
somehow,
why did this become a priority?
Right. Why is this something to fight now?
And
right.
Why did they suddenly back off when the story broke about all the ties to Harry Reid?
That wasn't why it broke off, was it?
Well, come on, Rob.
It was some pretty curious timing. I mean, it was like within 24 hours of that story breaking.
Was
that,
it that or that,
that
they
the
didn't
BLM
want, or
backed
they didn't
off.
Want to have a David Koresh Waco moment?
Well, maybe.
They burned down Ruby Ridge. They burned down Waco. Why would they have any hesitation to burn down this guy?
Well,
too?
I don't think they were happy about burning it down. I think they high-fived each other.
I think you should watch those documentaries and see how happy they were.
So Rosa Parks refused to abide by the law, too. Would you have had her incarcerated?
Killing my liberals.
Oh, Jerry, your tab's on me tonight. You just knocked it out of the park.
My head just exploded.
Wow. We'll take a break while Rob gathers his gray matter and stuffs it back in his ears. And
I mean, this is what I was saying before. There is a higher standard.
You're Rosa Parks, brain exploder, raises the question of just laws. Right?
Yes.
Right. That's
exactly.
What you're raising.
Right.
And for whatever reason, maybe I'm like far out into liberal lefty land, but it seems like the idea that the federal government owns the land and they allow the use of it for a fee doesn't seem... It seems like an agreement. That seems like a handshake. It seems like mutually beneficial to all parties.
Right.
Yeah, that's our thing. I'll let you use it. You got to pay me a little thing, and I can say whether your cattle can stomp on my box turtles or whatever. Whatever the thing is, that sounds like an agreement. That doesn't sound like oppression to me. But if you're of a certain bent, Jerry, then all laws coming from a large federal government will smack of oppression when they come at the point of a gun.
Yeah.
Well... Let's talk about another aspect of the whole rounding up of the cattle. The free speech zones that were imposed on the protesters.
Don't
wave your hand off.
I wave. There's hand waving.
Free speech zones, that is not... I mean, that is... It's number one.
But that's happening.
Freedom of speech.
No, that's true for any kind of protest. If I want to go march a Ku Klux Klan rally right down Market Street, I can't just organize all of my KKK buddies, well, there's many of them, and start marching out. No, I need a permit, right? And I need a permit that says I'm going to march my KKK rally. And it doesn't mean I don't have First Amendment rights. It's that you must protest in a... You have to protest nicely.
So that's part of the... I don't remember reading that. That you were going to be sectioned off in the...
Congress shall pass no law, right? Isn't that how the First Amendment starts?
Limiting.
Abridging.
It's not really a bridge. It was more like a fenced-in area.
Yeah, I mean, the whole First Amendment zone thing is an issue.
I think that was bad optics, but I think that's true for every protest that you have.
But
you Occupy Wall Street... They said you can occupy Wall Street in this occupy zone. Otherwise, we're cracking some skulls.
Let me back up just a little bit though to your previous point, and I'm gonna throw you a little curveball here.
Uh oh, another one?
Well, because the grazing fees thing itself, I don't have a problem with that, and I think that's the way it should work. But here's why. Because there should be no public land. There should be no federally owned land. All of that should be privately owned. And if he wants to graze his cows on it, he should be paying the owner of that privately owned land.
And right now he's paying the owner, which is the feds.
Which is unconstitutional.
Right.
I mean, if you look at Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, the federal government cannot own land unless the state legislature approves it and they have been justly compensated for the land.
Well, both of those things must have happened. I mean, they've owned it since forever.
Well,
since,
and like you pointed out in the pre-show, this land was purchased before Nevada was a state. But I say that shouldn't matter. Because the Constitution is the Constitution, and it says the state's land belongs to the state unless it has been ceded to the federal government for, I think it's forts, armories, and other needful buildings.
That sounds like constitutional
power. Yeah. And
needful buildings.
Yeah, and so all of those things, you know, are legitimate uses by the federal government, but it still has to be approved by the state legislature, and they have to be compensated.
But didn't that all happen?
Well, I don't know.
I would guess it did.
I would guess it didn't.
I would guess it did. I mean, it's been this long.
Doesn't mean that doesn't mean anything. I mean, it could have happened.
Okay, so you're raising a question about. The abstract ability and the constitutional ability for the federal government to own land, which is, hey, that's definitely worth discussing. But I'm disputing the idea of this guy being the cause celeb of true patriotism and libertarian arguments. I think it's a guy that just didn't want to follow the law that was all agreed upon.
All right. But it's not that he just didn't want to follow the law. It's because he doesn't view the law as legitimate. He's taken a stand against an illegitimate law, just like Rosa Parks did.
It's a good one. It's a good one. It's a good one from, like, especially a conservative perspective. That's why this one's particularly interesting with the history of it. You know,
it's like
this has been this way for 170 years, and certain conservatives, they don't like change, and so I think it raises interesting issues with history, I guess. You know, it's kind of like the Snowden thing. It comes back to like the Snowden thing. Snowden didn't think the NSA should be able to have this data.
Right.
Well, he signed agreements that said, you will see this data, you will protect it. He followed signed all these agreements and said, you know what about all those agreements? Screw them. I'm going to renege on all of the things that I signed because I don't believe it anymore.
Well, like, it's not that he didn't believe it anymore. He believed that those agreements were hiding information of criminal activity that the American people needed to know about.
Oh.
And so he decided to take a stand against what he saw as an illegitimate law.
So what's the point of anything anymore? Anybody can just claim anything?
Not anything.
But it should be judged by the morality and sense of justice to the individual.
So why is opposing a law judged by that out of line? I mean, but the government is not judged by that same standard.
Right.
Tell me how.
Tell you how. Look at any law that's passed. It's passed. Well, we all voted on it, so therefore it's good. And even people who protest say, whoa, no, we don't agree with that. Say, well, too bad, it's the law.
So is that an argument against democracy?
Indirectly.
It's anarchist man says.
But it's primarily an argument against laws that are passed just because the majority wants them. They may or may not be moral. I mean, the Fugitive Slave Laws was passed in 1850 by Congress. Didn't mean it was a legitimate law.
As
it turned out, it wasn't.
Right.
And juries continue to refuse to convict people when they were tried for violating it,
right?
Until it eventually, you know, was declared.
And this plays into your tyranny of democracy.
That's an aspect of juries that is no longer really exercised.
Right. Because the judge will give them instructions that, you know, they have to They have to rule on the evidence presented.
Right. And the laws that...
Not the merits of the law itself.
Right.
Which was not the original intent.
No.
And that goes back to the FBI agent, who is, to me, it goes back to... He's looking for people who are anti-government.
Right.
And that's, you said that's his job. But if he believes that's not his job, then he should have the ability to oppose that task, his job.
And I'm sure there are some who do. But, I mean, he's like the lawyer that does what's called voir dire questioning of a potential juror,
right,
asking them questions about what are your feelings about the government, you know, and if you say anything remotely controversial,
boom, you're out.
Right, they dismiss you. You're not eligible to serve on the jury.
Well, that's not all that true. If they think you're going to be the one that's going to hit the acquittal, you're the defense attorney.
Right,
but you know, I get your point.
Yeah, I mean, both sides get to do that questioning, and they throw out the people they feel are controversial. But should they be allowed to do that? I mean, it's a jury of your peers, right? Should be chosen at random. There shouldn't be this post-selection process where they weed out the jurors who might be biased in one way or another. All right, so we're kind of off in the weeds now.
I like the weeds.
All right, we're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about a little bit of listener feedback from the last episode. So stay with us. We are back once again. Going to dive into a little listener feedback here. Our listener Eric had quite a bit to say about our last episode regarding conspiracy theories. But one thing here in particular leapt out at us because he was in agreement with Jeremy about climate change.
Hey, whoa.
It's like, Eric, are you feeling all right?
Well, he's...
He's off his meds.
He's addressed this before. He's asked me...
Yeah, right.
If I could separate the policy from the science, then would I believe in global warming or climate change? And still I don't.
Okay.
So this is not really new ground.
Well, and so Eric says, I agree with Jeremy, shocking, that the policy decisions made about climate change tend to be short-sighted. There's a real disconnect from what the fairly established science says and how that should impact policy. Well, I agree with that.
I agree with that, too. And I saw a recent Al Gore. He realized he hadn't been in the news for several months, so he had to say something. And he was talking about how deniers are this, and they're wasting time and resources. So I wonder what he says about his idea. Well, I know what he says about his promotion of ethanol for so long. That was the solution.
Right. Yeah.
Never mind that it took drinking water away from people who needed it. It drove the price of feed corn up for ranchers.
Right.
So therefore drove the price of meat up. There's just this waterfall of things that it impacted and harmed, but that was okay because that was his idea.
Yeah.
Anybody counter to that, but they're the problem. And it's, you lump him in with Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, who is now a bishop, apparently, because she was washing the feet of immigrants. let me go off topic here for a second. Hey. What a pandering, worthless individual. And maybe that's a little strong, but...
Well, and I'm sure Nancy Pelosi is listening, so she will probably have a rebuttal
for us.
She's
not, some of her staffers better be.
And on this Good Friday, as the resident Catholic here, I think it is distasteful, because the washing of the feet is one of the most sacramental moments in the Catholic year, maybe the Christian year.
Well, it's Christian because she's Episcopal.
Right. But to use, it's the ultimate flipping of the hierarchy. When Jesus washed the feet of the disciples, that's what it's all about. And she's flipping it back. She's negating it one more time and putting herself as the...
Look at me. Look what I'm doing. Yeah.
It's the most evil...
Do I remind you of anybody?
Right. Exactly.
Do I?
Oh, and let me make sure it's immigrants, because immigration is a big topic right now. My party is trying to pass a bill...
Yep. That's one of the most distasteful
and how anybody can support that, I don't know.
Okay, yeah, so she's disgusting. Let's get back on topic
here. Yeah,
there
we go.
So, there is a disconnect between the science and the policy. How do we fix that? I'm not sure. I mean, I think we've gone pretty far down this road already, and there's a lot of people that are committed to it regardless of the disconnect. And so... You know, there's a lot of momentum, and I don't know how you come back from that.
I don't know either, because I support a lot of the energy, like real solutions, not wind farms, not selling land to Chinese solar companies, not subsidizing solar companies that eventually go out of business, nothing like that, but real solutions. I pull stuff out of the trash and throw it in the recycle bin. To save the landfills and, you know, whatever else.
Right.
But save the
landfill? Is that like save the whales?
Save the whales. Well, we have a good landfill around here that's on fire and going to release a bunch of nuclear material. But, you know, don't worry about that. Just keep
underground fire with nuclear waste nearby.
That sounds like an energy source.
It's a great situation.
Yeah, we're wasting it.
Why did that happen?
So, I mean, it comes back to a point I made several episodes ago about, you know, that the climate change crowd needs a good spokesperson. They need a Neil deGrasse Tyson or somebody equivalent who can get out there and not only sell the science, but be able to recommend policy and explain the policy in such a way that, you know, that Jeremy is actually going to buy into it.
Right.
And you know, that person doesn't exist yet.
Well, no.
That person doesn't exist, and I don't think that person is going to exist, because they keep talking out of both sides of their mouth. While the Great Lakes are experiencing historic levels of ice, and what are they doing? I keep seeing how they're battling the ice. They're trying to keep the lakes open for commerce and this horrible ice. Well, wait a minute. We're complaining that we don't have enough ice, and now you're breaking up the ice.
Come on!
Don't give me the come on,
Rob. You were doing a great job. Come on, Eric. Eric's gonna destroy.
You're saying the ice just isn't in the right place. So
right, we need it. Let's move the ice. Ooh, there's an idea. Let's move the ice from the Great Lakes up the Arctic. The ice is too low.
I could see somebody actually proposing that. Loading the ice on giant sleds and taking it up to the Arctic.
What are we doing? Okay, what? What's our plan? Because if ice is good, if cold winters are good, then why are we breaking it up?
Well, I don't know that. I think you're oversimplifying that a little bit.
I am. Yeah. And so are the alarmists.
Right. Indeed.
And never mind. Okay. Now the IPCC has extended the tipping point another 15 years.
Yeah.
They've done that. This is about the third time they've done that. They did.
Oh, it's not the third time. Well, they've been moving those goalposts for 40 years.
Okay.
So. I mean, they being that camp, not necessarily the IPCC, but.
Well, you know, fine. I'm oversimplifying. They're oversimplifying. That's my point, Rob.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
Right. All right. So, yeah, what color is the zebra? Right? Come back to that. Is the zebra black with white stripes, or is it white with black stripes? Let's
white with black stripes, and they finally figured out why they have stripes, and it's a deterrent for flies.
Let's nail that down.
It is.
I didn't know that.
I believe that science. Hey, there's a study that proves something. It confuses the flies, the biting flies that are coming in to land.
They don't know where to land.
They don't know where to land. It was a study, Rob.
Yeah, okay. It was a study.
I've been watching a lot of Wildcrats on PBS where they talk about animal behaviors.
There's a lot of
flippy causal arrows going on that show. Like did the zebras evolve to get the flies to stop doing that, or did zebras just happen to show up and the flies didn't like it?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how you do a study like that.
Right, right. I mean, you could say flies prefer not stripy things. But I totally agree with that.
But I do know one thing. The federal government paid for that study.
And therefore, we paid for that study.
Yes.
I just did April 15th. That felt good, too. I love tax day.
Yeah, I know you do.
I get so every time
I visit
my
school and hug it.
All right, go on.
All right, so Eric also apparently agrees with you that Roswell was more than just a weather balloon.
Somebody kidnapped Eric and hijacked his computer, apparently.
So he mentions that they declassified Project Mogul, which I have to admit I had never heard of. It was a secret program, so the weather balloon story was a cover for it. So, yes, it was a cover-up, but not of an alien spacecraft.
Alright.
Now, do you go that far?
Project Mogul from Wikipedia says it was balloons going to the stratosphere to with microphones to check on Soviet nuclear testing.
Oh, well, there you have it.
Alright.
Okay.
Fine.
And Chuck Norris was in charge of the program, according to Wikipedia. So, I mean, do you go that far that it was not an alien spacecraft?
Maybe not. I really don't know.
Okay.
But it wasn't.
It wasn't what they said it was.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. Okay.
I think
we've established that, and I stand corrected. So as a conspiracy theory, does that mean it's done? It's dead? Or are there still people clinging to the hope that, you know, they recovered alien bodies there and they did an alien
autopsy?
Yeah.
Come on, where
do you draw the line? I mean, how far are you going to take that one?
I don't know.
Alien autopsy, is that legit?
I saw bits and pieces of that, and it seemed pretty hokey to me.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
Okay, all good.
Right. It was meant to be hokey, so you thought it was hokey.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Take that.
All right, so that may be... That may be the end of listener feedback. One thing I wanted to mention here, one story that's in the show notes. Let me find the link here. Where is it? Crap. Oh, we briefly talked about this. The new Washington War Machine. That was the story about the small town in Iowa that got an MRAP.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'd encourage everybody to read that. In case you don't believe that, you know, the military surplus equipment is not finding its way into small town America, this was a an excellent editorial by the local newspaper.
Go ahead.
No, sorry, you go.
Finish,
go ahead.
It was your
story. Go ahead.
No, finish what you were going to say because I have something related, but from a different source.
Well, just that, you know, he was trying to figure out how this town of, I don't know, was it 1,500?
Yes.
How the local sheriff was going to justify having this, you know, this giant piece of military hardware in a town that, you know, barely has any crime at all.
And if you know, an MRAP is a mine-resistant assault
vehicle?
MRAP.
It's mine-resistant armored personnel.
Armored personnel, right,
yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's this giant vehicle that can withstand landmines, you know, when it drives over them. It won't kill everybody inside. Are there a lot of landmines in Iowa? I'm just curious.
There's cow patties.
Well, there you go. Maybe that's it.
I happen to get a magazine that's National Defense Magazine. Not sure how I get it or why I get it. It just started showing up. So I started getting this magazine. Recently, there was an article in there along these same lines, although it was championing this as, oh, look at this great acquisition program. That, I mean, this is a model acquisition program, the streamlining of these surplus vehicles to people who need them.
Right.
It was such a different
to the people who need them. And it's like, not an acquisition program.
Right.
Because no money is changing hands. They are just donating this stuff. Yeah, okay. Last one I wanted to mention here. The title here is The Culture of Shut Up. Excellent, excellent essay. I would encourage everybody to read it.
What's it about?
Even you, Rob.
I haven't seen it. What's it about?
It's about how discourse in this country is broken because, you know, everybody is told to shut up when they say something that's unpopular.
You disagree with me, you can get out.
Yeah, right. And
well, we're an example on the MPP, right?
Yeah. And you know, so I replied to the author on Twitter and I said, hey, that, you know, spot on. And that's kind of why we started our podcast,
right,
was to combat this culture of shut up. So
that's right. Even though you guys are wrong, I love you.
Yeah. Same here.
Right.
All right. I think that's it for us. I want to thank GC for hosting us once again. Thank our listeners. Send us your feedback. We'd love to hear from you. And we will see you next time.
Good night.
Bye now.
But they've made a calculation that it was worth doing this as part of America's defense against terrorism. Surely that makes it a price worth paying.
Well, when you look at the results of these programs stopping terrorism, you'll see that that's unfounded. And you don't have to take my word for it, because we've had the first open court, the first federal court that's reviewed this outside of sort of the secrecy arrangement, called these programs Orwellian and likely unconstitutional. The Congress, who has access to be briefed on these things and now has the desire to be, has produced bills to reform it. And two independent White House panels who reviewed all of the classified evidence said these programs have never stopped a single terrorist attack that was imminent in the United States. So is it really terrorism that we're stopping? Do these programs have any value at all? I say no, and all three branches of the American government say no as well.